Trendstorm.
Our final topic, picked by you, dear listeners, earlier in a poll on our Facebook page, is Donbas, from assassination to invasion, focusing on the future of this rebellious region. The East Ukrainian region of Donbas is on pins and needles following the assassination of Alexander Zakharchenko, with some fearing that the killing might encourage Kiev to once again invade the self-proclaimed republics. Russia watchers were shocked when the news came in last week that a terrorist explosion at a local cafe in Donetsk claimed the life of the famous rebel leader, with the first reaction being to brace for what some predicted would be an imminent onslaught by Kiev. After all, the Ukrainian forces have been engaged in non-stop but low-intensity hostilities with the Donbas militia for the past few years now, and despite the Minsk agreements, the war between the two never truly ended. That said, the speculated invasion never happened, or at least not yet, and various explanations exist for why that is, ranging from the disciplined preparedness of the rebel militias in spite of the terrorist provocation to the theory that Kiev never really intended to commence another large-scale attack, but had other reasons for carrying out the assassination. About that, while Kiev denies its involvement in the terrorist explosion, the rebels are certain that it was responsible, and Russia seemed to say as much the other day when Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova declared that there are all grounds to believe that the Kiev regime is behind his murder, as it repeatedly used similar methods to eliminate dissidents and opponents. Looking forward, the future of the Minsk agreements is in jeopardy, though that's not because of anything that Russia has or hasn't done. To the contrary, Moscow reaffirmed its commitment to this peacemaking instrument while sharply criticizing Kiev for continuing to sabotage it, which could also be interpreted as alluding to its complicity in the recent terrorist attack. These concerns aren't anything new, but they take on a heightened significance after what just happened because they show that Ukraine is willing to up the ante by assassinating rebel leaders. This terrorist provocation is bound to trigger some form or another of revenge by the rebels, and the dangerous tit-for-tat that might unfold could ultimately unravel the Minsk agreements once and for all. Gosh, folks, I want to begin this segment by saying that we here in Moscow are so sorry about what happened in Donetsk. We have so much sympathy for everybody in the republics. So terrorism needs to be condemned in all of its forms, and what just took place last week in Donetsk was clearly a terrorist attack in Europe. So having said that, we're going to begin this analysis, and we're going to start by speaking to Mr. Patrick John Lancaster. He's the crowd-funded American independent journalist who has been on the ground and in the trenches covering the Ukraine war from the Donetsk People's Republic for the entirety of the war.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Patrick, what did Kiev hope to accomplish by killing Zakharchenko? Was it to prepare the ground for a surprise invasion that didn't pan out for whatever reason, destabilize the republic, contribute to the psychological war that it's waging in the Donbas people, or perhaps something else?
Well, I think the assassination of the head of the republic really is just kind of the next domino to fall, because as we've seen in this war, there's been many assassinations over the last 4 years. The commander, Givi Motorola, and there's been many other attempts. I think the perpetrators of this assassination basically wanted to kind of destabilize or help destabilize any type of governmental daily actions going on, because there's been so many attempts on both Zakharchenko and many other people in higher ranking areas of the government that it's almost like they're just using a shotgun with buckshot, and every once in a while they land a good hit. And when they do, that helps to destabilize the situation of the new republic.
Okay, well, with everything you just explained, it sounds like to me, as you said, that one of the main objectives that Kiev had in carrying out this assassination was to destabilize the republic, but it does seem like, much to Kiev's surprise, that the republic wasn't really that destabilized. I mean, Donetsk was able to remain, at least from what we can tell, outside of the republic, relatively stable despite this externally provoked uncertainty they wanted to unleash. Now, Patrick, what does this say about Donetsk's viability as a functioning, albeit unrecognized, state?
Anyone that's been in Donetsk during this war, or anyone that I see that comes, is very surprised on actually how functional it is. I mean, when you're in the center of Donetsk, you would never be able to fathom that Donetsk is the capital of this breakaway republic that is under constant shelling, daily shelling, and in constant battle in different areas of the republic. It's really a functioning republic, and Donetsk as a city, as a capital, is really functioning very well. The people at the beginning of the war were very scared of what was going to happen next, and most of the city basically just closed down when the war started. Almost every business was closed, but then people realized it wasn't just going to go away. So people started coming out of their basements, coming out of the shelters, and to basically start living again, regardless of the fact that there are daily shellings going on around Donetsk and around the Republic, and people are dying almost every day there. But people just made the decision to just keep living and moving on with daily life and doing what they have to do to survive, despite the fact that there are daily shellings.
Okay, yeah, this is very inspirational, Patrick. Thank you so much for informing us all about that. From what I can gather, it does sound like Donetsk is pretty stable, functioning, and strong, despite what recently happened there. So, Patrick, how do you foresee the rebels responding to this terrorist provocation then? And are they more likely to keep their response within the realm of so-called shadow wars and tit-for-tat assassinations and things like that? Or do you think there's a credible chance that they might actually surprise Kiev by one day, whether soon or in the coming future, whatnot, going on the conventional counteroffensive and liberating some nearby occupied territories?
Well, I think a lot of people in the Donetsk People's Republic would like to see a strong response by the DPR and take back some of the other areas that used to belong to the Donetsk People's Republic, because people have family on both sides of the contact line. But I've seen with my own eyes for several years now, the DPR is making a full-hearted effort to try to stick by the Minsk agreements, and they have not been taking new territory because they're following the Minsk agreements. And I could be wrong, but I don't foresee DPR going in a full-fledged offensive just because of the fact that they're trying to do it. They're trying to win the war more with the pen instead of the sword. They're trying to keep their word as far as the Minkankak groups go. So unless something really drastically happens, like the OSCE or other observation groups leaving the contact line, because if that happens, the situation is going to bubble over, basically, is because it really helps when there's these observational groups monitoring the situation. It helps to keep the peace. But back to the point, I do not foresee a full-fledged offensive from the Donetsk People's Republic.
Patrick, thanks so much for sharing your on-the-ground analysis with us about the assassination, as well as explaining why Donetsk will continue to respect the Minsk Agreement despite the latest terrorist provocation. Now we're going to hear what Mr. Jafe Arnold has to say. He's an independent analyst and the founding editor-in-chief of Eurasianist Internet Archive.
Trendstorm.
Okay, Jafe, what do you make out of the timing of Zakharchenko's assassination when considering the prevailing false flag fears in Syria at the moment and the strategic commonality of these two conflicts as proxy wars between the U.S. and Syria?
Hi, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be on again. Thank you. I think it's really worth emphasizing that the assassination of Zakharchenko was a real shock. I don't think anyone expected in the slightest that, of all people, Donetsk People's Republic leader Zakharchenko would be the next victim of terrorism in Donbass. And like you said, this happened not only right as the suspense has been extremely high surrounding Syria, but also as tensions in Donbass have shown signs of escalation. Around the time of Zakharchenko's assassination, we saw an upswing in Ukrainian military operations across the Donbass front line, There were new reported sightings of NATO instructors and foreign mercenaries increasingly active on the ground. And plus, we just saw the U.S.'s envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, announce a huge expansion of U.S. military assistance to Kiev. So the fact of the matter is that, yes, there is a very transparent geopolitical background to both the conflicts in Syria and Ukraine and Donbass. Sure, well, since the very beginning, both the wars in Syria and Ukraine have been the products of U.S. orchestration, and the course of both conflicts has consistently correlated with the actions of the U.S. Now, with the U.S.'s proxies on the verge of being completely rooted in Syria, it's unsurprising, in my opinion, that the trigger would be pulled again on the Donbass front by U.S. proxies in one way or another. And another thing that should be mentioned on this note, I think, is that the Minsk agreements were temporarily tactical or strategic precisely because they cemented the standstill in Donbass, which allowed Russia to redirect its resources to the Syrian front. And now with the Syrian front entering what might be its final period, it's only natural that Donbass would flare up again. So while Zakharchenko's assassination was a shock, the outbreak of new hostilities in Donbass was, and in my opinion, is to be expected. And in the final analysis, I think that Zakharchenko's assassination can be summed up as a challenge to Russia, a challenge to the status quo in Donbass, which Russia has been more or less able to successfully maintain with the People's Republics of Donbass, perhaps until now. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that Zakharchenko's murder was an attempt at provoking Russia to overplay its hand. As usual, Russia has not succumbed to provocations. But the fact remains that one of Russia's key allies, a Donbass leader, the Donbass leader, has been killed on Russia's watch. And this is clearly a sign that Moscow is faced with the momentous challenge of keeping the Donbass front, so to say, safe or prepared during this critical time for operations in Syria. And in my opinion, this means that all eyes should be on how Russia is going to use its influence in Donbass in the coming days, and how Russia is going to raise the Donbass issue in diplomatic forums.
Okay, well, all this makes a lot of sense. I'm very happy that you clarified this for us, because I think some of our audience was wondering, I mean, what was the connection between Syria and Donbass? And you brilliantly articulated that, Jafe, so thank you for that. Now, you brought up the Minsk agreements, which are, of course, in everyone's mind. So what effect, if any, will Ukraine's planned termination of the 1997 friendship treaty with Russia, which will expire next month, but could theoretically be renewed for another decade if both parties agree, have on these agreements? I mean, you mentioned the agreements are pretty much a temporary tactical move to redirect Russian attention towards Syria, but as you also explained, with the war seemingly winding up, or at least the military kinetic phase of it winding up in Syria, and possible escalations following in Ukraine, what could all of this bode for the Minsk agreements?
I think three things are unavoidably important here on the Ukrainian front. First of all, this is not the first time that Ukraine has threatened to abandon the Russian-Ukrainian Friendship Treaty. And actually, many Russian politicians and analysts themselves have argued that the treaty should be scrapped. Why? Well, because this treaty has been rendered essentially pointless today. Kiev habitually violates the rights of Russians in Ukraine, repressing the linguistic rights of Russian speakers, denying Russian citizens the right to vote in Russian elections, and frankly speaking, Andrew, unleashing physical terror against people who do not identify with the new state-imposed ideology of Ukrainian identity. And all the while, as the so-called friendship treaty still stands, Ukraine has pursued what can really be called a genocidal campaign against not only the people of Donbass in the war, but everyone and everything deemed Russian. So the main points of the 1997-1998 treaty, such as strategic partnership and mutual commitment to non-aggression, have all been trampled over by Ukraine or rendered contrary to the interests of peace and cooperation by Kiev's actions. Secondly, I want to say that Kiev has never been committed to the Minsk agreements. If we take a trip down memory lane, we'll remember that Ukraine begrudgingly begged for and pledged allegiance to the Minsk agreements only when it was on the verge of defeat. But in reality, Ukraine has not fulfilled a single point of the agreements and has repeatedly violated them with military operations against Donbass on a daily basis. And really, Andrew, any quick glance at the Ukrainian media sphere or any survey of policymaking in Kiev is enough to show that Ukrainian political discourse treats the Minsk agreements like a temporary evil. The third point is that Ukraine's withdrawal from the Friendship Treaty would be a massive concession by Kiev to those radical nationalist lobbies, which have repeatedly called on Poroshenko to sever all relations with and even declare war on Russia. In order to win the upcoming Ukrainian presidential elections, the extremely unpopular Poroshenko has to cave in one way or another to this discontent but armed and powerful lobby. So even if the friendship treaty is largely only a piece of paper now, which nobody believes in, there is something potentially explosive here. If Ukraine withdraws from the Friendship Treaty, it would be tearing up the last remnants of official Russian-Ukrainian relations and would be demonstrating on a very symbolic level that it has no interest in peace and cooperation. And in the process, Kiev would be pandering to those groups explicitly advocating a regional or even world war. So in my opinion, that would be a major step by Kiev towards a restart to the war in Donbass. It would open up a Pandora's box, which the Minsk agreements would have little chance of surviving without external intervention.
Okay, very well said, especially the significance that this would have on domestic Ukrainian politics and, of course, the situation in Donbass. Well, Jafe, we have under a minute left, so I want to be very quick. I have a final question to ask you, and that's about the likelihood that Russia's incipient approaches with France and Germany, two of its Normandy 4 partners, can have on stabilizing the situation in Donbass and preventing the outbreak of a larger war. We unfortunately have just about half a minute, so if you can just be real quick.
Sure. Well, I think there's a very important geopolitical context here, too, because we've reached a point at which I think the European Union's major actors, especially the Normandy format members, France and Germany, are simply beyond tired of the black hole of violence, corruption and antagonization that is Ukraine. Also, not only is the EU in crisis, but the whole Atlanticist project between Washington and Brussels, which was behind the so-called Ukrainian project, is in crisis. And the EU is now being betrayed or targeted by Washington, which means that European elites and the Atlanticist geopolitics that they've clung to are having the rug torn out from under them. So in this situation, I think the EU is bound to recognize, probably sooner rather than later, that it simply cannot afford to patronize the Kiev regime and further antagonize relations with Russia. So if Russia plays its cards right, it could convince Germany and France to put pressure on Ukraine to carry out the Minsk agreements, which Russia has officially said there is no other alternative to. This, of course, depends on European elites coming to their senses. So the ball is in Europe's court now.
Jafe, this was a really educational conversation about how Zakharchenko's assassination fits into the larger perspective of new Cold War geopolitics. I, and I'm sure our audience as well, surely learned a lot.
Trendstorm.
Okay, folks, if we think back on what both Patrick and Jafe shared this today, we can agree that definitely what happened last week was a terrorist attack, and it caught many Russia watchers off guard, even though there were some indications that something of the sort may have been planned. Now, having said that, we do see that Kiev had many reasons for carrying out what it did, but it does not look like they're going to invade the rebel republic, or at least not yet. Now, at the same time, for as imperfect as the Minsk agreements are, what Patrick explained to us, and I thought this was very valuable, is that Donetsk will respect them, despite the latest terrorist provocation. That's very important to keep in mind, because this shows that only one party is respecting the agreements, and those are the rebel republics. Kiev, however, continues to carry out terrorist attacks and shelling provocations, and just continues to make the situation a lot worse. So folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com. or find us on Facebook. And with this, we end this week's edition of Trendstorm, brought to you by Radio Sputnik. It was presented by me, Andrew Korepko. Thank you for listening, and take care.